Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Jatapada Kamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamsa Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitang Tang Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakan Vitangsta Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Chaksur Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Mukham Karoti Vachalam Bhangolang Hayate Girim Yat Kripa Tamahang Bande Sri Gurundina Tarinam Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stabitam Jena Bhutale Shayam Rupakatamayam Dadati Shabhadantikam Nindantam Pulakot Korena Bikasam Nipa Prasunat Chavim Prodrikritva Bujadvayam Hari Hari Eat Uchai Vidantam Muhu Nritantam Drutamasru Nirjara Chai Sinchantam Urvitalam Gayantam Nija Parasadai Parivratam Sri Gaura Chandram Nama Ananda Lila Maya Vigrahaya Himavadivyachchavisundaraya Tasmai Mahaprema Rasapradaya Chaitanya Chandraya Namo Namaste Vande Nanda Rajastrinam Padarenum Abhikshnasa Yasam Harikatol Gitam Punati Bhuvanatrayam. Yes, Prabhu.
Dhanavad Maharaj. We have a question from Dhananjaya Prabhu, Russia. Very often we hear about 10 million cupids in their full-blown cupidity who feign seeing the beauty of Lord Gaurasundar. Also in Pranam Mantra to the deities of Sanatana Goswami, we meet the name of Madan Mohan applied to the Lord. While the concept of eros as the driving principle is more or less conceivable, the personality of Cupid remains beyond the grasp. Who is that Cupid and what position is he taking?
Just consider the personification of Eros in this world. Really, as Guru Maharaj says, we're talking about polar opposites. So, means the pull of the principle of Eros upon everyone in this world, for the purpose of discussion, we have the personification, Madan, Cupid, etc. The personification really of a principle. The only true personification that embodies that principle is Madan Mohan Krishna. So Guru Maharaj will point out in this, Jayatam Surato Pango Mama Mandamaterigati Matsarvasva Padam Bhavojo Sri Radha Madana Mohana. That as Madan Mohan, Krishna is capable of exerting that attraction in the polar opposite of what we experience at present. So what we experience at present is that the sense that by acquiring, controlling, and consuming, we will achieve fulfillment. And what the beautiful, sensuous things of this world, if we can acquire, control, and consume them, we will achieve happiness or fulfillment. And that drive, it's the driving force, the principle of material existence. So in the Gita, Urdvamulamadashakyam, the example is given that says this world is like a perverted reflection of the original. Right. Where do we see that? It says like a tree whose roots are upward and the branches are downward. In two ways. One way to say, the roots of this perverted reflection of existence are upward, but they're being reflected downward. It's a perverted reflection of the upper world. But we're told, on the bank of a river, when you look at the reflection, you're seeing a tree in an inverted position. So, in this plane, we're seduced by the potential of fulfillment through adopting the position of a consumer. Right? So taking ourselves as the subject and everything else as the object of our fulfillment. This is alluded to by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his Harvard commencement address, when he talks about humanism being the disastrous deviation of the Enlightenment. He said, wherein they put, by putting man as the center of all things, and hence here, the personification of the erotic principle being Cupid, putting man as the center of all things, and the purpose of everything is its relationship in terms of fulfilling the aspirations of man, right? Saying in that act, they have conveniently removed divinity. It's akin to relatively modern thinkers, pragmatists, who suggest that in this language, we should concern ourselves with those whose opinion matters. And what they mean by that is to say, look, these gods, goddesses, Cupid, if you want, Zeus, you know, or in your Vedic, what do you call it, pantheon, you know, Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, Shiva. Come on, you don't know, I don't know, we don't have any direct experience of such things. So, but you know me, I know you, we know so many others. Let's concern ourselves with those whose opinions matter. Right? We'll be best directed. Our energy will be best directed by concerning ourselves with opinions of those who matter, which means us. Right? And that sounds reasonable up to a point. But then they go further to say that, so in one fell swoop, God's been eliminated. The gods, the goddesses, come on. So that's out of the picture. That cannot be verified by us, so their so-called opinions do not matter. Only ours do. Man is at the in the central position and the measure of all things. But they go further to say that, and really, where are the aspirations of man best expressed? We know some people, they're not so articulate, or they're shy, or whatever it might be. How will their voice be heard? Certainly, we will enrich ourselves by hearing this chorus of voices, like democracy. Right. So I say the those who best represent the voices of everyone are those who are engaged in what is sometimes described as adventures of the intelligence, which means the creative arts and more specifically writers. So the gifted writer is the medium for the expression of the voice of the man who's plowing the field or growing the rice or the taxi driver or the wife or whoever it might be who is stereotypically and conventionally thought of as not someone who can best express their opinions or articulate them, but their voices should be heard and their opinions matter. Right? And we should concern ourselves with those whose opinions matter. And couple this with the saying that, you know, if you want to tell the truth, write fiction. Or art is a lie that tells the truth. So now it's becoming more interesting. I'm saying, so where we will find our guidance and tune in to the best voices to be heard will be in the adventures of the intelligence of these great writers. They have that capacity. But if that is the case, why did we dismiss? Now we're saying what is not verifiably true, which are creative arts, right? It's not verifiably true. You cannot prove that something is beautiful or possesses aesthetic beauty. It's something that cannot be proven. You can sense that, you may experience that, it may be revealed to you, but you cannot prove it. So initially we were dismissing the voices of the gods, the goddesses, or by extension, the scriptures, the shastras, on the basis that they cannot be objectively they are not verifiably true. But then when we pursue this other route, we're told the most valuable truths that we will gather will come from fiction, which by its definition is not verifiably true. So if these voices there expressing these truths based upon what is sometimes also called, you know, one person said of a great writer, we need nothing more than his authorial voice. Like, this is presented so well, so perfectly, so profoundly, the authorial voice is sufficient evidence for its own verification. And you say, well, that's a wonderful thing to say about a writer, and I'm not saying it's untrue. Rather, I like to explore that idea, but extend it further too. So here on the other hand, that you say this revealed truth is not verifiably true, right? So we're going to, and the voices that may be heard there and what they're expressing will eliminate that from our consideration because it doesn't matter. But then on the other hand, you're telling us what really matters, the opinions of those whose matters is best expressed in fiction. Do you understand? Why should this be dismissed? why did I take this route? Oh yes, you're not taking notes. Oh, because we were talking about Cupid as expressed within this realm and Madan Mohan at the other extreme. So, yes, so In the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, there's a saying, Atma Prajnanamayo, Guru Maharaj mentions, that the supreme truth, the supreme reality, is self-effulgent, in that sense, self-illuminating, self-revealing, self-evident. Here we have the authorial voice, and that's sufficient. Then this will be sufficient. Guru Maharaj mentions that he heard Srila Saraswati Thakur give an example that of a child born in a dungeon. And we're talking about, you know, how do you say, old school dungeons, no windows. The only light available there is a torch. So someone from the outside world comes and says, you know, I got a special permission to take you outside and show you the sun. And the person who spent their whole life in the dungeon says, well, let me get a torch so we can see it. The person says, no, you don't understand. A torch is not required to see the sun. The person in the dungeon saying, what am I, a fool? What can be seen without the aid of a torch? Saying, no, please come with me and see the sun. And he said, then upon seeing the sun, he's like, oh. So overwhelming and illumination and revelation. Here, the torch is, you know, rational thought. Right? So there's a class of things saying, what can be understood without, you know, rational thought, logic, etc. And there's a certain case that can be made for that. But contextually, but when we're dealing with what is subjective, it will not only help us, it may misguide us. Right? Because when we're dealing with the subjective, we're talking about what is beautiful, right? What is sweet, what is charming, eros, all of these things are subjective. Right? As the old saying goes, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. That means it's a subjective thing. That something is subjective does not mean that it is not real. Right? Humor is subjective. That something is funny, I cannot prove that something is funny. That does not mean that funny doesn't exist. But while we're on the subject, during the lockdown, one lady spent the weekend with her son, you know, a little kid, and Monday came and she's saying, well, he's saying, where are you going? He said, well, it's Monday and mommy has to go to work. And he said, Monday isn't real. And I thought, we might have a little philosopher in our, you know, midst. So there's Monday isn't real. So he's right. So we deal in abstractions still. They're helpful to us. But in the inverse, just because something is, you know, because Monday is subjective, doesn't mean it's not real in another context. I get what he's saying, and I happen to agree with him. But there's another realm in which Monday has its value. Yeah. That may be a poor example, but an example nonetheless. That someone or something is beautiful cannot be proved. Right. And we were speaking the other day of the origin of the word aesthetics. Meaning that which is perceived by the senses, but over the course of 100 years or so, it became synonymous with the culture of beauty. Right? Meaning that the beauty that can be perceived by the senses, the beauty that can be seen, the beauty that can be heard, the beautiful sound, the beautiful aroma, the soft touch, right? Taste. Some people will say in the objective world, you know, taste is a relative thing. But I think it was perhaps George Bernard Shaw, just to take it to the extreme with a little bit, he said, well, then should we say the difference between a cannibal and a vegetarian is a matter of taste? Right? Sometimes an extreme will show the flaw in that type of thinking. But still, that said, there are people who, again, in the objective world, and say, well, who established these persons as the connoisseurs? That what they say is tasteful is actually tasteful. It's still a relative thing. It may be. But in the subjective realm, is there no room for such connoisseurs? Is there no standard of measurement or gradation or evaluation, assessment? In the I'm thinking of John Hick, a Christian theologian. He put forth this notion, or this within the statement, he said, Christianity is on the verge of a Copernican revolution. And what he meant was, up until the time of Copernicus, people conceived of a geocentric world, with the earth at the center and the sun and the planets orbiting the earth. Then came along Copernicus, said actually it's heliocentric, it's a solar system. The sun is at the center and there are so many planets that are orbiting around the sun. And we might add to that, and at varying degrees of nearness or being remote. And we say the ones who are more near or more alike. So he said, Christianity is on the verge of a Copernican revolution. He said, and he's a Christian theologian, and he was not abandoning Christianity. He was just, we might say, having an epiphany. And he said, up to this point, we thought this is the central conception, and there are others orbiting it, near or far. He said, but what we're going to realize, that there is one supreme absolute truth, and this is one of many theistic systems, the orbiting that central absolute truth. Cupid's like one of those planets orbiting the Krishna. But to proceed further, right? So if we're saying, well, there are, for some, it would be enough to admit that there's a plurality of theistic systems. They might be quite proud of themselves, actually. You know, yes, I believe there are many religions. You know, I accept all of them. Or the old yatamat tatapat, as many ways as you can conceive, there are that many paths. That's to take it to the extreme. Or, you know, all the paths lead to the top of the mountain. That's not true. I don't know. People just hear something like that and go, yeah, right, that's profound, but untrue. Try taking any path and going to the top of a mountain. I followed a guidebook when I went to Badrinath. So that, as I say, for some, it would be enough to acknowledge that there's a plurality. And then they would think, my job is done. You know, I'm graciously, generously accepting that there are many legitimate religious traditions. I wish everyone well. And, you know. But if there's a plurality, then there must be gradation. On the basis of something Guru Maharaj said, I take this in a particular direction. So he is saying, what he will say is, you need to measure, how do you say, to establish the relative value of any particular system, you need to measure it against an absolute standard. So we will say that standard is rasa. Which is not easy to translate because it can mean liquid, mellow, love, juice, you know. Like, but for the sake of this, we'll say, you know, the love aspect and loving intimacy. Just as we see now in the present situation, currency fluctuation. So we will see, if you look on any chart, they'll say one of the, say the US dollar over there, and then it'll say Thai baht, you know, 32 or 33, Russian ruble, 75, Indian, you know, this much, pound, this much, renminbi, yuan, this much. So it's not one to one. So in the world of currency, we recognize there's a plurality, but it would be a false assumption to think that they all are equal. So in this context, just in this context, the US dollar is like in the absolute position. And then all these others are measured against it. Their relative value is established and its relationship to this absolute. Then you find that it's seven of these, or 35 of those, or 75 of these to equal one of these. Right. All of them have value. It is not to say they are valueless, but it is not one to one. So there are so many theistic systems orbiting that central absolute truth, but they're not one-to-one in terms of their value. So to measure them, the standard will be rasa, right? Loving intimacy. So we will, the premise will be, according to the degree of that any theistic system accommodates, promotes, loving intimacy, and to what degree it will show superior qualities and be assessed of higher value. That's the premise. So, what are the different theistic systems, concepts of relationship with divinity? For the most part, it is one of awe and reverence, you know, awe and reverential devotion. Right? But that betrays a lack of intimacy. It means distance, not nearness. As in this world, the president, the king, the Prime Minister does not have an intimate relationship with the citizenry. And on account of that, the appropriate mood of relationship is awe and reverence, right? But it means distance, but it's a natural distance. So whenever they appear, in the citizens are full of awe and reverence toward the chief executive, or, you know, king, prime minister, president, right, who's supreme in that context. But they may be privileged to see the entourage, right, of the, how shall we call him, supreme executive, chief executive. They see he has an entourage. And the entourage, they're also deferential. But because they're somewhat nearer, he may know their names, even their wives, their children. There might be some rapport between them, on a little increased intimacy, right? Not so distant. And that entourage, they are privileged to see, they, you know, his interaction with his wife, children, mother, relative, friends. Like, he has some friends he went to school with. And those, that group of friends that he went to school with, they might know his nicknames. Some of them might even be humorous. And from his friends, if they sometimes, in a joking way, insult him, it's giving him delight. Where, because on account of the nearness and the increased intimacy of them, it appears to be giving him delight, the prodding of his friends. So we see they're gradually transcending the awe and reverential aspect, right? And they're privy to see the wife, the mother, etc., the more intimate relations. So if we move along with this sort of analysis, we'll see that to the degree that there is loving intimacy, that the awe and reverential aspect recedes into the background. They know who he is, but their love and affection eclipses that understanding. It goes into the background so that they can have either friendly dealings, or the mother. We know the mother can come and grab him by the ear and say, "Listen to your mother." And he'll go, yes, mom, I will do that. I will do what you say. Right? Why, how can she exert such control over him? She has no legal right to do so. She has no constitutional power or authority to be to deal in that way. From anyone else, the guns would come out, right? But from its mother, everyone has to, like. And he has to obey his mother. Why? Out of love and affection, not rules or laws or constitutional clause in the Constitution. Then he also has his consort, right? And there that relationship is private, right? So that means he also has the erotic tendency, right? But that is a private matter. So if we like Rupa Goswami has analyzed these in the five relationships, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhura, Svakya, Parakya. So he's saying these five types of loving relationships are possible with the Supreme Absolute, the Sweet Absolute. In which theistic system are they accommodated? I don't know what percent to give. 99% sounds like a good number to use. 99% of the theistic systems in the world do not even remotely approach us. They remain in the on-reverential default mode, which again is a legitimate position, but is understood to be a distant one. Even within Vedic culture, for the most part, it does not accommodate this, what the speaker promoted. Right? The so-called Vaikuntha world, right? Bahunam janmanamante jnanavan mam prapadyate vasudev sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabha. Krishna says, after many, many bahunam janmanamante, after many, many lifetimes, may mean millions of lifetimes, one may come to the conclusion, jnanavan, one who finally will know and understand Vasudev Sarvamiti, that Vasudev, Krishna, is the source of everything, including the erotic principle. Everything means everything. Right. I say, you mean like we've seen in this world? Right. As you mean, whom the humanist removed and put man in the center as the measure of all things? Rather, and just to, we're told the goddess Saraswati puts words into the mouths of the opponents of divinity at different times. So if we wanted to be generous, we could say, as Guru Maharaj did in quoting one Bengali poet, he's saying, man is higher than God. And all the humanists are cheering, yes. But what he means to say is the human-like pastimes of divinity are superior to the majestic aspects of divinity. At least if we allow Guru Maharaj to mercifully Krishnize these statements. So when the human, if they say, man is the measure of all things, then we'll say, yes, the central conception of the infinite should be the measure of all things. The extremes being Brahman, all-accommodating Brahma, all-permeating Paramatma, greater than the greatest, smaller than the smallest. What's the central conception of the infinite? The golden mean of the infinite? The human-like aspect whose charm, is it kandarpa koti kamani avishesha shobham, as irresistible as 10 million cupids. If the one cupid of this world is irresistible, then, and I was thinking about this earlier today, because, and as Dhananjaya Prabhu said, when he says, we often hear, and I was saying, he often hears it from me. And I'm saying, maybe it's not as, maybe my degree of emphasis is not standard, but it is often heard from me. I'll concede that. And yet you will hear it again. As I was thinking about, I am obsessed with this subject, actually, and also with this number, 10 million, Because as I said the other day, that when we were talking about that Radhar Swarup, Krishna Prem, Kapalata, Radharani being, you know, a Kapalata of Krishna Prem, and the gopis being the twigs, etc., 10 million times greater pleasure. And I was thinking, how is that possible? And again, 10 million. So first of all, let's say 10 million, it in a sense, just for the sake of this talk, let's say, that's as far as your brain can go without blowing a fuse. So that's just like we hear, to the nth degree. Just 10 million, something a little more you could wrap your brain around before it explodes. But it's, I remember as a child in school when I saw, the first time I saw Ad Infinitum, I can still see a nun writing it on the blackboard saying, and these numbers go like this, and then you put this line, and that means to infinity. And my mind was blown. As I've mentioned before, the intro to a TV show, I was told I could watch this and then I had to go to bed on a school night. And this Dr. Zorba would come on with chalk and a blackboard and he would go, man, oh wait, man, woman, birth, death, infinity. I really like that. Hence, infinity media. So 10 million. So this Cupid, this cherub, right? Cherubic form we see in the paintings of the Western masters, right? The Renaissance or before, do you know? Yeah, I believe so. The little chubby cherubic Cupid with the bow, Cupid's bow, the lips compared to Cupid's bow. The personification, and go back to what we said before, you know, Monday isn't real. All right. The Cupid of this world may not be real in a personified form, but that icon is there to represent that principle, that tendency, that however unverifiable is as real as anything and intrinsic to our existence. The erotic principle, eros, cannot be separated from our existence. This is Srila Saraswati Thakur. He said, you cannot remove that principle any more than it would be to do away with the existence of the jiva. Auden, we are eros and dust. So, the example. So of the supreme executive, president, prime minister, king. So we will see that this principle of extreme loving intimacy, including eros, I said about Vasudev Sarvamiti. And crossing that, you enter the southern hemisphere of the spiritual world, the Vaikuntha world, where what do we find? 2.5 rasas. Shanta, Dasya. Right? The Aishwarya aspect, the majestic aspect of divinity, Vaikuntha, an unlimited display, Lakshmi and Narayan. And I said, too, why 2.5? Because we hear from Srila Guru Maharaj, and it's perhaps extracted from the Brihad Bhagavatamritam of Sanatana Goswami Prabhu, that in the case of some, because there's gradation everywhere and everything, that we learn from Guru Maharaj. everywhere and in everything, in the Brahma Jyoti, so those with microscopic vision can distinguish between the different souls and their different swaroops. In the undifferentiated plane, those with as an offset printing with a loop, you can see cyan, magenta, yellow, and black, which otherwise looks like a uniform color from a distance. There is gradation in everywhere and everything. So what is the half? In the case of some old-time servitors, like back to that entourage, even though they're servants, dasya rasa, pridami, they're borderline friends. Like the old servants, been so long with the master, there's a slight degree of friendship there. It's a very beautiful thing. As Vaikunth, the southern hemisphere transitions north to Ayodhya, but Rupa Goswami in Dwaraka, Rupa Goswami just goes, you know, Vaikunthas Janito Bara Madhupuri. Guru Maharaj says, in one leap from Vaikuntha to Mathura. Why? Janita, birth pastimes of Krishna. But we can say Sita Ram in Ayodhya, the Dwaraka queens and there, but he goes to Madhupuri. Shyama eva param rupam puri madhupuri bara. Right? The supreme madhu, Mathura, but madhu, sweetness, madhura. Why? But we say, well, that Mathura, yeah, it's Mathura, Vrindavan, ahoyte shrestha govardhana shoyla, Gandharvika giridhari jatakrita koyla, more refined, sweeter than Vrindavan, Govardhan, more Radhakund, and then their differentiation everywhere and everything, Radhakunda tata on the bank, and the jalka in the waters. So, 10 million times, Kandarpakoti Kamaniya Vishesha Shobham. Really, it's infinite. But because that is, achintya, this number is given not as hyperbole, but actually almost the inverse. Just to bring it to the point where you can conceive on some level, which would make us faint if we can think, that Cupid principle amplified to a 10 million magnitude, like when you take the number and have the, what is that part called? Power, right? To the infinite power. How beautiful, that's what they're saying. Kandarpa koti kamaniya vishesha shobham. The only reference point, you have your objective Cupid of this world, they're saying, magnify that 10 million times. But really, it's to the infinite power. And that is the seductive charm, beauty of Krishna. So therefore, Guru Maharaj is saying, and combine Krishna with Radharani as Mahaprabhu. So he says, koti kami murchitangri rupa rasa rangaram, that 10 million cupids would faint to see the beauty of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So only in the central conception of the infinite, the golden mean of the infinite, Krishnara jateka kela saratam naralila naravabhutahara swarup, Gopa Vesh Venukar Navakishore Natubar Naralila Hoy Anurup. The human-like pastimes actually are the of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, reality the beautiful, are the template for human civilization, not the inverse. It's not that we're projecting. What is it? Anthropomorphism? No, it is the inverse. The human-like pastimes of Krishna are perverted, reflected here, the template for human civilization. So to an example, like Saka Chandra Nai, and Nyai, remember, logic has its value. So we're told there, it's the logic of seeing the moon through the branches of a tree. Right? So if I say to you, and I go, you see the moon over there? And you go, no, I don't see it. I go, you see that tree? All right, yeah. Go up the trunk of that tree and see the branch on the right? Go out to the, oh, yeah, I see, there's the moon. I see it. So the example is not the proof. It's just, it assists us in precisely locating the truth, viewing it. So when we, this is a method for helping us to point us in the direction, that Cupid of this world you're familiar with, either by, in a visual sense or an abstract sense as an icon representing the principle of Eros and its power to afflict the heart, to drive one to madness in seeking its fulfillment. Right? Way beyond, to make one totally irrational in the search for fulfillment, to be so obsessed, Guru Maharaj said, poetry of Kalidas. What is to say for like Hansadut, that is a Rupa Goswami has a Hansadut. There may be other, it means swan messenger. So Guru Maharaj said, we can conceive of a swan being a messenger. Yeah. And it's very beautiful. Actually, it's Lalita Sakhi chastising Krishna, telling a swan what that swan needs to go and tell Krishna. How he's misbehaving and not treating his beloved fairly. So Guru Maharaj said, we can conceive how swan can be Hansaduta. But Kalidas has written Megadut, the cloud as messenger. That's more of a stretch. Now we're going more and more abstract. But he's saying, how can it be? He said, because when one is totally mad, madan, mad with lust, everything can be a medium for its expression. So even the cloud can be a message. That's what he said. That's the intensity of the madness of Eros. And everyone of a particular age knows what I'm talking about, if they're honest and candid. We're talking about that type of madness and searching for fulfillment. And then through extrapolation, we're saying, amplify that 10 million times. And that's just the low end number. Amplify that to 10 million times, and you're going in the direction of the beauty, the seductive charm of Krishna. That's what we're being told. And Madan Mohan, the reason Madan would be mentioned, because we're in the stranglehold of Eros in this world. That's it. And it's either it's expressing itself in different ways, or its repression is expressing itself in different ways. But it is the driving principle of material existence, because it's the driving principle in the original. Janmadyasya yataha. Vedanta, Janmadyasya yatonvaya ditra, and the Bhagavatam. And what does Chakravarti Thakur tell us? Janma Adi, the Adi word here means Adi Rasa, Adyo Eva Rasopara. It's the original. It's the source of everything, but it's not an abstract principle. The true personification of Eros is Madan Mohan Krishna. And Madan Mohan Mohini Radha Thakurani. Everything is coming from them. Gurumar said, Madhva says, there's a thing. Right? Then the devata of that thing, the Guru Tattva, Nityananda, and Radha Krishna Govinda Chidli Lilamritam. And I love this so beautifully, Gurumar said. He can say this in all humility and perfection, he says. But I say just the opposite. And I'm dancing. Radha Govinda Chidli Lamritam, Nityananda Balaram, the Devata, you know, the Guru Tattva, the Devata, the thing. Janmad yasya yataha, Vasudev sarvamiti, ahang sarvasya prabhavo. Everything is coming from him, from them. Krishna is not alone. It is the original principle in all of its purity and beauty and charm and sweetness. But even within Vedic literature, there are different representations of Madan and Ananga, who does not possess any limbs. There are different ways of approaching this, yet exert so much power. But Krishna, and beautifully, when Mahaprabhu is wandering in the Vrindavan forest, we're told, you know, when he's in Jagannath Puri, he's deeply immersed in Krishna Prem. But as he starts approaching the Vrindavan, it increases 100 times. As he gets nearer, and when he's in the forest of Vrindavan, thousands and millions of times. Again, it's to indicate a particular magnitude of intensity, of ecstatic depth, experience, emotion, feeling. And there in his divine madness in the forest of Vrindavan, you know, two parrots fly and land on his, and one is praising Madan Mohan Krishna and saying, my Krishna is Madan, he's so beautiful, charming, even Cupid, and everyone in the universe and beyond is irresistibly drawn in attraction to the beauty of Krishna. Suk, parrots. Then the other parrot, Sari, the female, she said, yes, but that Krishna, he is only achieves that position, as we told, the full-blown cupidity, in the presence of Sri Radhika. She brings this out in Krishna to its fullest expression. So Krishna, reality of the beautiful, he's most beautiful and most sweet and irresistible, enchanting at her side. And then she goes on the front and saying, otherwise he is bewildered by her. Hare. We're told Hari, who steals, takes away, Hari. It's not his. Chitta Hari, the mind stealer. Right? But Radharani Gurumar said as Hare, she can steal Krishna's mind. What is her power, her greatness? She can steal the mind of Krishna. And how? Revealed in the pages of Sri Chaitanya Charitamritam in the beginning, and then you can understand this book is unlike any other. He says, the Vedas, they're singing my glories and my praises. They're praising him for his innumerable avatars, whereby he comes into this world to rescue and reclaim fallen souls. As innumerable as the waves of the ocean. And they're offering so much praise to Krishna. Right? Deva Deva, the God's God, the Adi Devi, the original Lord. And praising his pastimes and saying so much glorification. And he said, but my beloved, Srimati Radharani, she's cursing me for some misbehavior on my part, talking about transcending the awe and reverential majestic aspect of divinity. She's cursing him. And what does he say? And it's stealing my mind away from the reverential hymns of the Vedas. They're telling him how great he is. He's the great, you are the greatest of the greatest. You know, Param Brahma, Param Dham, Pavitram, Paramam Bhavan. You know. And she's telling them that his behavior is not so great, but in an extreme way, cursing him is the word used. And he's saying, the sweetness of that infused and that emotional outburst from her is stealing his mind away from the reverential hymns of the Vedas. So this is an inconceivable plane that we hear of in the pages of Charitamritam. By the grace of our Guru Varga, we're sometimes given a glimpse. And sometimes some reference is made to the things of this world of which we have some experience to serve as a means through amplification and degrees of magnitude to point to the upper world. But Guru Maharaj said, and these three, Madan Mohan, Govinda, Gopinath, you're being told from the beginning of the Madan Mohan deity, it's being, he's saying, in a vague way, which is appropriate, because it is understandably, to go into detail is so likely to be misunderstood that it is injurious for us in the neophyte position. But we're told through Madan Mohan, in a vague way, this prospect is being announced. Who can break, who can charm Cupid or break the stranglehold that Cupid, the mundane Eros, has upon the heart, release that and allow what? To enter some non-differentiated neutrality? No, that where that principle will achieve its ultimate fulfillment, Gopinath, and the means Govinda. Sarvapadi vinirmuktam tat paratena nirmalam rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhakti ruchate. By using the senses that are so, what are we saying when we're talking about Blake, if the doors of perception are cleansed, the infinite will be revealed. So the process of devotional service, performing simple acts of devotion under the guidance of Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, and Vaishnav, cleanse the doors of perception, the senses, and then the charm of the infinite in terms of seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling is revealed. But again, indicated in Madan Mohan Krishna. Hare Krishna.